Hey, this is former Blue Devil lineman Matt Skura. You're listening to Basketball Conference, the ACC football podcast. Go Duke, go ACC.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to Basketball Conference, the ACC football podcast. My name's Joey Weaver. He's Mike McDaniel. Mike, season recaps. We roll on. We know what we say about Virginia, right?
Virginia's off. Virginia's there it off. Is.
Oh, good. On a loop. Beautiful. Justin Ferber joining us, editor-in-chief, Cavs Corner. Justin, you know what we're about to do here. We're about to recap the Virginia football season. You're always so gracious with your time. We appreciate you joining us. How's it going?
Pretty good. I would say most UVA fans, if they're listening to this, would probably rather look forward than back, but let's do a little bit of both, I guess.
We'll do both.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like looking back is kind of part of looking forward because, you know, I see this, and it's a season where Virginia goes 3-9, and obviously that's not ideal, you know, pretty well removed from bowl eligibility, but I also see a team that went 2-5 in one-score games. I see a team that I felt like eye test-wise looked quite a bit better towards the end of the season than they did at the beginning. I feel like there was confidence that grew in me that this Tony Elliott and his staff, that it's going to work out, that it's going to improve over the coming years. Did you get the same sense just yourself, or do you sense the same from the fan base that there's confidence building in this regime?
I mean, I think in the first half of the season, you know, they start 0-5. So, and we kind of, I remember, you know, when we talked in August, we talked about that possibly happening, you know, based on the schedule that they had. And, you know, it's really tough when you're in that stretch to feel good about anything, even though some of those games were close. The fifth loss was to Boston College, and that one was one where Boston College was not playing well. I honestly think they were probably one of the worst teams in the league, even though they won seven games.
Don't have to tell me, buddy.
My opinions on Boston College.
Yeah, they played like a really soft schedule, but that's, you know, you can talk about that when you preview them. but, yeah, I mean, I think, like, after that, they sort of, I don't want to say they like found momentum because they didn't really, you know, they didn't turn it into a bunch of wins, but they started to kind of play a little bit better. And, you know, the North Carolina win was huge, I think, for Elliott and his program and just kind of showing that they can accomplish some things. Cause I mean, like, even in year one, you know, the bright spots were super hard to find. And then obviously, everything that happened off the field that ended that season happened. And that kind of is another thing that you have to sort of overcome. And there's no blueprint for that. But yeah, I thought like they were competitive. I mean, you mentioned the 2-5 in close games, like, and some of those games were, you know, like the Boston College game, games that they could have won, but just didn't make enough plays, but they were close. NC State, another one, you know, is tied with like, 30 seconds left, and then NC State goes down and makes a field goal after some bad penalties. And, you know, Louisville, that game, I think they were up at least 7 in the fourth quarter. I think they might have been up 10 at one point after being down 14. And that's when Louisville was peaking. And that was on the road. And that one was, then they go to overtime with Miami and lose in overtime. You know, so they showed some promise, but they also had a few just like absolute disasters in there too. So I don't want to like, you know, just paint over that stuff. I mean, the Maryland game was bad in the second half. The Georgia Tech game was bad pretty much from the start. The Virginia Tech game was really bad. So, I mean, like there's still a lot of room for this team to move like towards consistency, but at least they were competitive against some teams that they weren't really expected to be. And then they won a few games. They beat Duke. They beat North Carolina, like I mentioned before. So, I mean, certainly felt better at the end of the season than at the beginning. But the way that the season ended against Tech was, you know, kind of a reality check, I guess.
It was kind of a weird year because I think the start of the year kind of went how we talked about, right? You brought that up, you know, in the preseason we were discussing it like, okay, the possibility of starting 0-5 is certainly there. That happened, but then, you know, like Joey mentioned, it felt like as the season went on, you know, Virginia started to kind of find their footing a little bit and show some signs. You mentioned the, you know, the North Carolina win being pretty significant, coming on the heels of the William & Mary win, getting on the board with the first one of the year. Really, it just felt like even in the close losses in the second half of the season, Virginia kind of had this like high variability, right? And the reason why I point to that is because Anthony Calandria started playing more significant snaps in the second half of the year with Tony Muscat getting hurt. I know Calandria played that one game, I think, in September, and then he was benched again when Muscat came back.
Yeah, he played, I think he played three.
Yeah.
Well, he finished the Tennessee game, but that was garbage time. Then right. He played JMU and Maryland and NC State.
Yeah. Right. So he's in the lineup. Joey and I are thinking that, you know, Calandria should just be the guy the rest of the way. They bring back Muscat into the fold, and Muscat kind of has a couple games where he's playing pretty well. Then he gets banged up again. Yep. Joey and I kept just flip-flopping on quarterbacks. We're like, okay, like the good healthy version of Muscat is pretty good. And, you know, Calandria, he's got some variability, but he's got some promise too. It just feels like the team took the identity of Calandria in the second half of the year when he was playing more snaps. Just felt like there was some high points that we weren't sure the offense was going to necessarily meet. And then there were also just some low points where it was like, okay, he's still a freshman. He's making those kinds of mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think like Muscat was the more consistent player, and I think that's why he was the starter in camp. Calandria, he looked really good in the spring. He enrolled early, and I was like, man, this guy looks like way better than the typical true freshman that you would see. And we weren't thinking he would play or anything, but you know, it's like, okay, maybe he can be a competent backup, and you know, you're one injury away from having to start him. So, you know, that kind of carried into the fall, and I think Muscat won the job. And I don't really think UVA had a quarterback competition at any point during the season, which is weird considering that they both played. But like, you know, Muscat had the job fairly in hand going into camp, kept it, started the year, got hurt. Calandria played when he was hurt. And I think a big reason that Muscat was able to take his job back so easily after those games that Calandria started was that UVA wasn't winning. They were 0-4. And, you know, Calandria, and this kind of carried on through the season, but, you know, he would have like some really high highs. And, you know, like the JMU game, he was really good. The first half of the Maryland game, he was really good. He kind of brought him back against NC State. And then later in the year, he had some similar moments, but then he just threw a lot of picks. And that's why like he became kind of a meme. He was just like, people were like, who is this guy? Like they would turn on UVA games because they had all these night games and they were, you know, he would just be winging the ball around and it was fun to watch, but you know, definitely like cost them a couple times with some just bad picks. And you expect that from a freshman. So you can't really blame him for that. And then Muscat was more consistent. I mean, he won the North Carolina game. He was in the Miami game that went to OT. Then he got hurt at the very beginning, the first drive, I think, of the Georgia Tech game. And then Calandria comes in, and Calandria played really poorly in that one. And I think that was because he just wasn't prepared to play. You know, he hadn't been practicing with the starters and all that good stuff for a few weeks. So, I mean, I think like, you know, the Duke win, he looked really good. He was pretty good in the Louisville game. The Virginia Tech game, I don't really want to put on him. I mean, he didn't play well, but I think there was like nobody was playing well. And I think that kind of, you know, made things spiral a little bit more than maybe they would have otherwise, but they just couldn't move the ball. And, you know, I think Calandria has more upside going into this season. And I think this spring and fall, you'll probably get into more of a quarterback controversy situation where it's like both guys are probably on even footing right now. And Muscat has less eligibility and Calandria is a more high upside guy. I mean, if I was betting right now, I think Calandria is probably the starter. But, you know, I think that they're going to kind of look at it because it's one of those situations too, where like, it's not like the staff inherited Muscat. They like went out and got him. So he's their guy too. You know, otherwise you see a lot of times coaches will want to play their guy if it's close. And I think this one, you know, it could be either guy, but I mean, it's one of those situations where, like, I wouldn't be surprised if they both play at some point just because Calandria is really small. And that was one of the reasons that UVA was able to get him in the first place is because he was so small. And, you know, Muscat obviously was hurt twice. So, you know, something to consider going into this year. But I'd say Calandria has the higher upside and could be a very good college quarterback. And then you get into the whole, like, can they keep him if he becomes that guy, you know, and that all that stuff. So,
yeah, all the wonderful things about college football in this day right. and age. Love it. I'm curious to get your take on this, Justin, or just at least your opinion, kind of where you stood. Was we saw a lot of the same things from Calandria, a guy who flashes a lot of potential, has a lot of exciting plays that he makes, but also is a freshman and makes a lot of very freshman throws, you know, going to turn the ball over a bunch, like that kind of thing. When they went back to Tony Musket, I remember, and this was when, again, Musket recovered from the injury that he'd suffered against Tennessee. I remember Mike and I talking about, like, I don't like this move. I think stick with Calandria, take your lumps. This guy is the future of your program. You know, you don't have to win anything right now, but you're showing potential at the moment. Did you agree with the decision to go back to Tony Musket, or were you kind of in that same camp of let's just stick with Calandria and see what happens?
We talked about it on our podcast and like, what's the right move, you know, and we were kind of, I think that we had like a split decision there. I mean, I know a couple of the other, there's three of us, and I know the other two were pretty strong in the like, just go back to Musket camp. And the reasoning was sound. I mean, it was like I said before, you know, like they weren't winning games. Calandria wasn't the problem necessarily, but I think at that point he had like thrown, I don't know, like five touchdowns and five picks. In the NC State game, he threw two in the second half, and they were both. The one thing I will say about Calandria is his interceptions and things like that are him trying to do too much. It's not like inaccurate throws. It's like he's putting balls into places they don't need to go. Mm-hmm. And that honestly, like for UVA football this year, like there wasn't a whole lot of like high expectations. You know, they don't have a bunch of guys on the roster that people were like fired up about necessarily, but you know, you want to see that because you'd rather see that than have somebody just checking it down constantly and not converting first downs. But yeah, I think there was some debate. I think it was a pretty easy decision for the staff because they had said, you know, and maybe they kind of pigeonholed themselves a little bit here, but they had been saying like the whole time, like when Tony comes back, he's the starter, like it's his job. And like, you know, they were 0-4. So that made it a little easier for them to be like, all right, let's see if we can get something going. And the game that Musket came back was against BC, which looked very winnable at that time. And he actually, I think in the first half of that game, he threw for like almost 300 yards. And then in the second half, they kind of imploded and ended up losing by three. And then he won against William & Mary and then won against Carolina. So like it was, he kind of kept his job until he got hurt again. And I think like it was easy to kind of make a case that what this team needed more than like big plays was consistency and that Musket could maybe do that. And you have to remember too, like when you're 0-4, and in your Tony Elliott in your second year after you went 3-7, you need to win games. Like, so he, I think that was his calculus too, was like, we can't like just look to 2024 yet until maybe it's like until we win some games and then feel better, you know? And at that point going into that William & Mary game, they really needed to win because, you know, things could have gone downhill very quickly if they didn't win that game. And then luckily, you know, for them, they won out of the bye. But yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to monitor this going forward, but like, you know, Musket's a veteran guy and, you know, it kind of sucks for him, honestly, because, you know, he came here to be the guy. There wasn't really competition. He had other offers. And now he might be in a situation where he has to fight with a guy that a young guy for his job, you know, so we'll see how it goes, but I expect it to be a pretty healthy competition. And if they go with Musket with that, you know, like they did last year, then that would be silly, I think. And I don't think they will do that. So
as far as Tony Elliott goes, and my question really, you know, I'll preface it by saying neither one of us really anticipated that Tony Elliott, even coming out of a rough year one, was really in any danger. And mm-hmm. that's with on-field performance, but before you even talk about what happened off the field, right. Like it's just not a situation where you would fire somebody, right? It's a really tough situation. You mentioned there not really being a blueprint for that. But when UVA starts 0-5 and, you know, you're going into that William & Mary game against a guy in Mike London who used to coach at Virginia, like optically yeah. speaking,
his whole staff is UVA guys too.
Right. Like optically speaking, you know, if you lose that game, I feel like any goodwill that's left, right, goes out the window. And then, you know, they go out and beat North Carolina. Was there ever any inkling, any indication that, like, if Elliott started, like, going down the rabbit hole of, like, this is going to be, like, a 1-11 type season, that UVA would move and you know, even just after 2 years, make a coaching change? I have no idea what his buyout situation is, but Joey and I have talked to a couple people who seem to, you know, have sourcing that thought that might be the case. So I'm just curious, kind of, you know, you cover UVA every day, so I'm just curious from your standpoint, kind of what you thought that looked like.
I would say the highest point of the hottest his seat got was probably after they lost to BC, before they played William and Mary, because then it's basically like, well, it can't get lower than losing this next game, being 0-6. You have to also remember one of their losses was to JMU, and people don't want to lose to JMU here. So, I mean, it's the same way at Tech. Like, those games, like, they don't maybe take on the same importance as, like, the, you know, your arch rivalry game, but, like, you don't want to lose to ODU, you don't want to lose to JMU. It makes people mad. even if JMU's good. And, you know, like, I think that the pressure was starting to kind of mount. I think, like, you made a good point, like, coaches don't get fired after 2 years at most places, unless you're Auburn or, you know, have a lot of money to throw at the situation or whatever. You know, and I think, like, we went into last season thinking, you know, it would have to be really, really bad, or it would have to be something like off the field or something like that, for it to get to that point. I think there were people, you know, we were getting to a place at 0-5 where, you know, it was, I don't want to say it was like in play, like about to happen, but there was definitely some people getting antsy. And also, and this is we'll probably talk about this again in the fall, his buyout is very, very low. Like, very, very low. It's like $4 million.
Affordable.
That's like, if they wanted to cut a check and pay for that.
Yeah. Affordable if they wanted to move.
Yeah. And the thing is, though, and, you know, this is true in any job, you can, the money, so, like, if you wanted to, like, let a coach go, a lot of times that money in Virginia, the state of Virginia is like this too. Like, the school can't, like, pay it. They have to get the money from donors, basically, to pay it, because he would have to be fired, like, for cause or whatever. And, you know, you can have people that want to do that, but if your athletic director and president aren't motivated to do it, they're the ones that have to actually do it, right? So, you know, if they're going to give him time, then he's going to get the time, even if there's some people that maybe aren't on board. And I think, like the North Carolina win, I think, ended any chances of that happening. You know, basically at that point, it's like, all right, they won two games. They were basically picked to win two or three games. It was the first time the school had ever beaten a top 10 team on the road, which is pretty wild, considering they've been playing football for like 130 years. But also Carolina being a top 10 team, like, remember that? That was like a very brief window of time.
Right.
Where they was like, oh, is Carolina going to go to the playoff? And, you know, then they were competitive in some other games. And I think at that point it was pretty clear that, you know, he was going to get more time. And not only did he get more time, they didn't make a single change to the staff. Like, everybody's back. And, you know, I think special teams is the one area where, like, you could definitely quibble with that, or at least talk about maybe reassigning some people. And I know it's only January, so, you know, who knows what will happen in the next few weeks, because coaches are still moving around. But I think, like, it's fair to say he's in a different place going into this year than he was going into last year, given everything that happened off the field, given every, you know, just the short time that he'd been there, you know, where the roster was. And that's another good point too. Like, it's not like he inherited an absolute disaster, because Bronco had gone to bowls or been bowl eligible like a bunch of years in a row, but the transition was weird. And it wasn't like a typical transition where, like, a team fires a coach who's underperforming and the players, like, are excited to start over with a new guy. There were some guys in that previous, like, that first locker room that he had that were just not in on this, and those guys left. You know, one of them, I think, transferred to another school in the ACC and played quarterback there, did a decent job. But I mean, like, I think this year, you know, he's bringing his guys back. He's got a lot of his players back. There's really not a lot of excuses, and the schedule isn't as bad. It's not great, but it's they kind of got a little bit lucky with the redoing of the schedules because they lost one of their toughest games and got a SMU instead. But yeah, I mean, I think it's time to start winning or at least being like much more competitive.
Based on what you kind of said, alluded to there, Justin, you said he made no staff changes. You mentioned that maybe would have considered special teams, but otherwise you seem like you're comfortable. You think it was the right move not to make any changes on the staff?
I think the thing is, I think most of the staff I wouldn't have done anything with because, you know, you could make a case that like the offense actually improved quite a bit from year one to year two, and they dealt with a lot of injuries, and the offensive line has just not been an ACC level offensive line yet. And the good thing for them this coming year is that they're bringing every player back basically that played. So you hope that you can improve, and then they've added some transfers. So I think like the offensive staff was pretty safe. The new wide receivers coach that replaced Marcus Higgins did a fantastic job with Malik Washington, which was a huge surprise. I mean, we thought he would be decent, but like not nearly as good as he was. And then the quarterback development has been quite honestly pretty good after Armstrong left. I mean, like there were a lot of people kind of scratching their heads about that, but Musket and Calandria were much better in this offense than Armstrong was. And you know, the defense took a step back this year, but I mean, if you look at how many guys they had out throughout the year, basically their entire pass rush was out, their entire secondary was out at different times, and they had to play a lot of young guys. So I'm not saying you excuse all that, but you kind of, it's easy to kind of say like, well, they were pretty good in year one and the year two was an injury year and they played some pretty good offenses. And you know, maybe you just run that back. And so you could maybe make like a change here or there if they felt like a guy wasn't a right fit or if a coach just left for another job, but that just hasn't happened. The only area, like I said before, that you could really make an obvious case that they need to make a change, and I would make this case, is that they need to do something different with special teams because, you know, they had two punts blocked that ended up as touchdowns, one against JMU in a game you lost by one, and one against Louisville in a game that you lost by seven. So yep. Those were pretty big plays. You gave up a kick return against Virginia Tech. That was one of the most embarrassing kick returns I've ever seen in my life. They just kind of jogged over and then he just ran by everybody. And I want to say, yeah. And they gave up a kick return to Maryland. So, I mean, that's terrible. Yeah. And their kicking operation and punting operation besides the punt blocks, and their field goal kicking operation was much better, but they have a kicking and punting guy, Drew Meyer. That's like their, you know, that's like not what I'm talking about. The special teams operation needs to improve. So I don't know what they're going to do to change that. It seems like they're going to keep the coaches, and they kind of do like a special teams by committee thing where like everybody coaches special teams. So they might just need to look at it from an operational standpoint and figure out if they can clean that up. But all the rest, I wasn't expecting wholesale changes. So, you know, we'll see if the continuity helps.
You mentioned Malik Washington as well, a guy that was developed. And I mean, he transfers in from Northwestern. To my knowledge, this is just a 1-year rental situation. He's out of eligibility at this point. But all he does, Justin, is come in and put up 110 catches, 1,400 yards, you know, led the ACC, I believe, in both categories and was like top five nationally in both categories.
Yeah. I think he was like second in yards and like third in catches or something like that.
Yeah, he's up there with some guy named like Roma Dunze and like Marvin Harrison in terms of stats. Yeah. So that seems like pretty good company to keep. But there's a good side of that, of, you know, that he was highly productive. There's the other side that Malik Washington being the sun, moon, and the stars of this Virginia passing game means that most nobody else contributed significantly. I mean, you had 58 catches from Malachi Fields, and that was the only other player who caught 20 passes in this team.
Yeah.
So moving forward without Malik Washington, now that he's out of eligibility, is there any concern on your end of the way that that group is being developed and that there's a lot of volume that has to be made up there next year, like immediately?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of a weird situation because like every week we were like, at some point these defenses are going to catch on to this, right? And he's not going to go for like 10 catches and 140 yards, because he did it just every single week basically.
There's one guy you got to cover, just yeah. cover him, and
it was
like they never
him
did.
And Fields, and like literally the any other receiver out there, you might as well just leave him alone. And the receivers that they played other than those two guys were mostly young guys. So, I mean, they're developing. They have a couple of younger guys that could definitely develop into decent players, and they just their playing time was sort of sporadic. So I think, like, you know, how do you replace all those yards and catches and touchdowns is a great question. And just based on what they've done in the portal and how the roster looks, I mean, the answer is they're gonna do it by committee, and you hope that you can put together, you know, a few guys that can make that up. And you know how the transfer portal is, like, they might be able to do that and then some, or they might not work at all. Like, who knows? But they bring in Chris Tyree from Notre Dame, who is a similar type player. You know, he started at running back and then moved to receiver, and he's kind of got the same profile as Malik Washington, not quite as productive catch wise at Notre Dame, but, you know, they had more guys to throw to than Washington had at Northwestern. But, you know, you hope you bring a guy like that in, and then they bring in, you know, a few other. They brought in a Trell Harris, a transfer from Kent State, who's pretty good. They brought in a really good tight end from Harvard, a position that they really haven't gotten much out of yet. But Elliott's offenses at Clemson always use tight end, so I think that's more of a personnel thing. Like, they just haven't had the guys. And they bring in Andre Green from Carolina, who was a borderline five-star recruit but didn't really do much there. He's a Virginia guy, so, you know, we'll see what happens with him. And then, you know, they have a few freshmen coming in, and like I said, they have a few guys from this past class of freshmen that could develop. And, you know, you hope that you can put together more of a consistent group rather than just one guy doing it all. But, you know, I think that what they did with Washington, and, you know, he deserves a lot of the credit, but, like, you know, he wasn't expected to be what he was. I mean, he caught like 50 passes or something, I think, at Northwestern the year before, maybe 60, and, like, really, really upped his game. So you have to hope that, you know, this staff can maybe develop the next group of guys. And that whole receiver room, I mean, like, you talked about the development of the room was impacted dramatically by the tragedy. I mean, two of the guys that died were receivers. And, you know, so then that room kind of got, you know, like, it just went through a dramatic change. Dontavian Wicks goes pro. He's obviously having a nice career so far. Yeah, I mean, I think, like, that room kind of went through a dramatic overhaul, and you hope that this year you start to see the gains of, like, all the young talent that brought in, and then the transfers.
Defensively, like, I feel like, you know, there were some games where I thought the defense kept Virginia in it, right? Then there were some other games where it was like, wow, what the hell happened here?
Yeah.
So very, like, very up and down, very inconsistent. Saw a lot of good, saw a lot of bad. So it was, you know, very similar to, you know, how the offense played, just very inconsistent. Level of concern there heading into 24, as far as what Virginia is bringing back, what they're losing. You know, I know that there are some guys there who are, you know, in some position groups that are, you know, going to have guys who are back for another year, and that'll be significant, right, from a continuity standpoint. So just kind of where's that defense at, like, stock-wise heading into 24?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first thing that they need to fix is the pass rush, which was pretty decent in the first year with the staff 2 years ago. But last year, I think they were dead last nationally in sacks. And it felt like they never got pressure on the quarterback. And it just, you know, the big thing you noticed is that the running quarterbacks really ripped them up. Like, Drones, King, I mean, you guys know those two guys pretty well. They both had huge games against UVA. You know, and then there were some other, I know I'm forgetting some, you know, Tagovailoa. He was pretty, you know, he's more of a scrambler than a runner, but he did some stuff. And, you know, then they had games when they played Tyler Van Dyke, they looked pretty good, you know, because he's just standing back there. And, you know, they were able to sort of defend. And, you know, they had a lot of turnover in the back end of the defense, too. They had to bring in some transfers. And, you know, that works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't work so well. And they had, you know, one of their starting safeties missed the whole year. Another one missed 10 games, I think. And then you're playing a lot of young guys, and you get used to seeing those guys back there, but you forget, like, they weren't really supposed to be starters. And I think they'll be, if they can stay healthier next year, that'll be a big step in the right direction, especially with the pass rush. Cam Butler, who's their best edge guy, he got hurt in the NC State game, which is the fourth game of the year. And he never, you know, he was done for the year. And he ended up leading the team in sacks, even though he only played 3.5 games. So that tells you something. And he got a waiver. I think he's like in his seventh year. So he'll be back, one of those guys. I asked him actually before last season, like, why'd you come back for your sixth year? And he was like, because I don't want to get a job. I was like, yeah, more power to you. No, but relatable. I think, yeah, and I think like if they can get some pressure on the quarterbacks and kind of contain some of the running quarterback elements, I think that'll be a huge step in the right direction. They do have some young guys that are promising. Cam Robinson at linebacker is a guy that people are really excited about. He was a top 10 player in the state. Tony Elliott's best recruiting win out of high school since he's been here. And, you know, he looked really dynamic when he got in there, had a pick six against Louisville, had some other big flash plays. They have a couple young corners that they like, and a young group of defensive linemen that played in a rotation last year and probably be asked to do more this year. So I think there's some optimism that they can be better than they were in 2023. I think that the real key is like, can they get after the quarterback and maybe force more turnovers and things like that? Because I don't think they're good enough or athletic enough across the defense to be, you know, like a bend but don't break type defense. And that's really what they did in 2022 because they had really, really good cornerback play with Fentrell Cypress, who ended up being a transfer to Florida State, and then another guy that went pro. And they were able to kind of like get by. But then when you had all those guys leave and less depth in the secondary and no pass rush, it kind of caught up to them at times.
You talk about needing to improve that defensive side of the ball a little bit. And I think a lot of what you're seeing teams do these days, bringing in guys with the transfer portal, but something that we've talked with folks on this podcast before and even, you know, regarding our own schools at times, like, it really feels like with the ACC, there's a lot of programs where it's the way that I put it is it's a lot easier to transfer out than it is to transfer in. And so I guess I'm curious to get your take on that of, you know, I see that Virginia's bringing in a couple of corners from the transfer portal, I think, and both guys, I think, from FCS, if I'm not mistaken.
They have four guys now because some of them are already on the roster. And then, but yeah, like they have some FCS guys and a couple MAC guys.
Yeah. But I guess I'm curious to just get your take on, is this also a thing of, you know, just being a football team for the University of Virginia, is it going to be kind of tough to bring in a lot of transfers to try to fill holes on the roster that way?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to, like, what do you have available for the player and what do they get out of it? You know, like, it's a transactional relationship. The Malik Washington, like, I'm sure he enjoyed his experience in Charlottesville, but that's a transactional thing. Like, I mean, he gets 1 year where he gets to be the guy. They got a really good receiver for a year, and now he's going to probably get drafted, and he wouldn't have been if he went pro last year. So that worked out for everybody, and he's probably going to get a graduate degree. You know, so UVA is in a kind of a different situation than some schools because they're not in the NIL game like some schools are. They've been making strides, you know, in that area, and they're more competitive than they probably were like a year ago. But, you know, in the ACC, you can probably get by with the NIL operation they have, but you're not going to be able to get a guy if it's like you versus Ole Miss or whatever. And NIL is a factor. You're just not going to, it's not happening. But, you know, like, you kind of have to go out and find guys that you think, you know, they've done a pretty good job of, like, picking guys at a lower level that they project as a guy that can play in the ACC. They've had success with transfers coming up from places like Harvard and Yale and, you know, other MAC schools and places like that, you know, other, you know, G5 level places. And they've had some Power 5 to Power 5 transfers, too, but even like a guy like Musket, he was an FCS player. He had an offer from Missouri, so it wasn't like UVA was the only school that thought he could play. But, you know, those are the types of guys they're going to have to get. And then they also have the academic piece. You can take a transfer if they meet the requirements, but the problem is UVA doesn't accept, and I know they're not the only school in this position, they don't accept all credits, right? So a lot of guys have to end up going backwards in their credits, you know, that they have. So if a guy is like a year away from graduating at, like, let's say ODU or wherever, and he wants to transfer for his last year, but then UVA is like, well, you're not going to be able to graduate in 1 year because you have to, like, you cut, instead of coming in with like 110 credits, you come in with 75, you know, or whatever. I'm just making up numbers. I don't remember how many credits there are anymore. but, you know, like that can be a factor, and, you know, that can maybe push a guy away. So they have some things that they have to deal with on that front. But, you know, they've had success in the portal at finding guys quickly, getting on them, you know, like developing relationships. They've also had some success bringing guys home, you know, getting guys that are from the state that went elsewhere, like Andre Green, I mentioned. Tyler Neville, the tight end from Harvard, is from Williamsburg. You know, guys, Muskets from Springfield. Chris Harris from Richmond. Like, they've had a lot of success getting those guys back, you know, because sometimes that's what they're looking for, is just to play closer to home. So that plus playing time being available has helped them. But, you know, there's certain guys that you're just not going to be able to get because the fit isn't there. You know, if they're looking for immediate playing time at a high level, UVA isn't at a high level. You know, they're not SEC Big Ten caliber football. If you're looking for NIL money, they're probably not going to be competitive with like the bigger schools. So, you know, it's all about fit. And at a place like UVA, you get a lot of guys that are trying to play ACC level football that aren't, you know, they're at a lower level. Or you get guys that are maybe looking for a shot at a place like Virginia where you have playing time available. You know, if they were at a bigger school, maybe that just they just could break in the rotation or whatever. And I feel like a lot of ACC schools are in the exact same spot, you know. So
we've had that discussion a lot in previous podcasts about it just seems like, you know, a lot of the schools in the ACC, they're benefiting from the portal in that, like, guys just want to. Guys just go, yes. Yeah. Very, like, on an extreme end of the spectrum, absolutely.
Yeah, like, I mean, what they're doing is, like, a completely different thing than what UVA is doing. And sometimes I think fans don't understand that. Like,
totally different.
They're not swimming in the same pool.
But specifically, like, bringing in guys who were from the state, went elsewhere, and then came back home, like Tech's having success with that too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But circling back to the offensive line, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, Elliott doesn't have like an ACC level offensive line yet. It's tough to portal offensive linemen, right? Like
it's almost impossible,
like continuity, the intricacies of the position. So how is the staff addressing that, I guess, from a player development standpoint first, and then from a portal standpoint, like how has he looked to address that, if at all, in the first couple of windows that he's had?
Yeah. I mean, this is an area where like, you know, I'll be critical when I feel like they've made a mistake or like haven't done something right in recruiting or like just roster management. This is an area where I feel like they kind of got screwed when they got here. So, you know, Bronco's last offensive line was good, his best one probably, especially pass blocking. That's why Brennan Armstrong sat back there for 20 seconds and threw for a million yards. All those guys either were out of eligibility or transferred or went pro, pretty much like the top seven guys, and that's very unusual. And they were kind of like, I mean, a lot of you can probably find people talking about this somewhere on the internet, but like they were almost like encouraged to go in the portal while like the coaching staff change was happening, and so that made it more difficult, even though they ended up retaining the offensive line coach for 1 year before he moved on. And so they really had like not much to work with, and like they had good offensive linemen, like Olu Oluwatimi was an All-American center, transfers to Michigan, and some of those guys probably would have left anyway, even if Bronco had stayed. But yeah, Tony came in and really didn't have a chance to, I don't think he had time to really keep those guys, like keep them out of the portal. And then, you know, going out and trying to replace those guys was almost impossible. So you get in a situation where it's like, you're working with the very end of your recruiting cycle. And they took a bunch of dudes at the end of that cycle, like five offensive linemen that were committed to other play like smaller schools or like under recruited kind of guys, and you just hope you can project them up to be a good enough player down the road. And in some ways that's working. I mean, a couple of those guys are probably going to be starters this year, and they've developed, and that's great. But I mean, some of those guys you're just going to miss on. So they kind of had to take some flyers. And then in the portal, they went out and got, what was it, like two or three offensive linemen in the first cycle. And you know, one worked out okay, one didn't play at all. You know how it is. It's just a crapshoot. And especially with offensive linemen, because I think those guys are, you're taking guys that aren't playing at the school they're at a lot of times and just hoping that they're good enough to play at your school. based on like film from practices and stuff. But you know, so then this cycle, their offensive line got a little older. They brought in a couple more transfers, had the same kind of results. One really good player from Dayton, you know, which is like non-scholarship football. He ended up being good, and he has another year. Then a couple of guys that'll probably be depth guys. But the young group that they had kind of inherited and then signed in their first class, like right after the staff got hired, those guys are now in their third season. And some of them are they're physically, you know, I just noticed when you go to practices and interview players, like they just look a lot different than when they first got here. And that's great. I mean, I think that that's you sign that they're developing and you're closer to playing and they're closer to being at that ACC level. And they had some moments last year with the line they had, but they didn't run the ball consistently. And then there were some games where teams just got after the quarterback a lot. And I think you're just hoping that this group can continue to develop and continue to develop. And, you know, you're in the second year with your offensive line coach who was previously at Stanford. And you kind of hope that he could continue to develop the guys he has, because there's not really a quick fix for this, you know, offensive line. It's not like receiver where you just bring in a guy and he's playing, you know, they have to be physically ready to go.
Mike, you good to hit on 2024 here?
Oh yeah. Yep.
And then we'll get out of here with you, Justin.
Sure.
So two things. One, I want to call out just kind of a weird schedule quirk, and we're recording this the evening of Sunday, the 21st of January. So we're a few days short of the actual schedule release.
Yeah, it's this week, dates. Right?
Yeah, it is. But we don't know dates. We just know matchups. So it's a real exciting schedule release, I guess, that's coming up. So we'll have an episode for you on that, I'm sure, coming up. But one of the things I look at is what is the longest road trip for Virginia this fall? Is it Notre Dame?
Like, yeah, they don't really go far, do they?
No. Coastal Carolina, Notre Dame, Virginia Tech, Clemson, Pittsburgh, Wake Forest, like...
The thing that sucks, though, is you have six, and that's the second year in a row now that you've had six road games. And I know Tech had the same thing last year, just the way the non-conference schedule falls. And one, it sucks for the athletic department because it's a drain on financial resources, not being able to sell tickets and have people come into town and all that stuff. And then also, it's just like when you struggle to win on the road, like a lot of teams do, like you're just adding another road trip, and it's like, you know. And for UVA this year, it's Coastal Carolina, which is like you could win that game because I think they're not bad, but I think they're kind of trending down. You know, they had a bunch of guys leave, and Grayson McCall's gone, and we'll see with that new staff.
Ain't Jamie Chadwell.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know that they're going to be able to keep at the level, but it's certainly not a game that you can't lose. But you have to go there. You're going to Notre Dame, which is kind of mandated. But yeah, they don't really go too far from home. Clemson or Notre Dame probably is as far as they're going to go. So,
well, and what we've been having fun with on some of these recaps is like, which California team do you have to go play? And Virginia doesn't even have to go.
They don't have one.
They don't even have to go on the road to play SMU. Like, they got SMU in their own building. So that's kind of a fun little quirk there.
And their schedule ended up being very similar to what it would have been, but they got rid of Florida State and added SMU. So like, that's a net win, I think. SMU was good last year, but they're not Florida State good.
That's a losable game, but it's not as losable as Florida State is.
Yeah, so. I did watch them a few weeks ago lose to Boston College. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But yeah, like I think their schedules, there's a lot of games on it where you just kind of throw your hands up and you're like, they could win that game, I guess, but they could also lose by two touchdowns. It really just depends on what this UVA team is.
Well, and so that was the other thing I wanted to ask you about is you were kind of alluding to this earlier was just I think you were kind of talking about how this fall it's kind of time to start winning. If we're putting like a record like expectation on it, in your mind, is it fair to say like Tony Elliott needs to make a bowl game this fall? Like, is 6-6 the minimum, or do you think like is 5-7 showing progress? Like, is that an okay expectation for this fall?
Yeah, I mean, I think like it would be 6-6 with the asterisk of like you never know. So like if they have like a horrific injury run or something, like, you know, things that are out of your control, or they start really slow and then they win 5-6 or something, you know, who knows, maybe you save your job that way. I would say like if you win less than 5, you know, it's a hard sell, because like what are you pitching at that point, to your donors, to your fans, to recruits? you know, because you've been kind of selling this like long term, you know, we're kind of stripping things down to the studs and rebuilding. And, you know, if they can take these close losses that they had last year and turn them into close wins, I think they could be better next year, especially if they get more consistent quarterback play and they can improve in some of those areas where they weren't good. I mean, I don't think it's like that crazy with their schedule to think they could get to 500 ish. The problem you have is like there's also not a lot of obvious wins. You know, it's like there's, you know, they don't have like one of those non-conference schedules where it's like, well, you're going 3-1 at a minimum because they play Maryland, they play Notre Dame. Like those aren't going to be easy. Even Coastal Carolina isn't going to be easy. And then in the ACC, you know, I feel like every ACC game is like, you know, you never know, except for like a few games. You know, it's, you go in, like even the games UVA played this year, like after they beat Carolina, it was, you never really felt like they didn't have a chance. So, you know, I think they'll have to find a way to just be better. They probably have to be better at home, an area where this staff hasn't been as good. You know, that they, as you know, like Broncos staff, they did a really nice job at home and just didn't win a lot on the road. And that's okay. A lot of teams do that, but this staff, you know, I think like, I forget what their home record is, but it's not good. You know, I think they've only won one ACC home game since Tony took over. So, and that was Duke this year, who were playing their like third string quarterback. So, I mean, they definitely need to work on that area, but yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think things need to trend in the right direction, but you know, how you get to that record could determine like what people think about it.
I know that, you know, Bronco Mendenhall just like set a really nice bar at UVA and then leaves kind of a little bit relatively unexpectedly and like a weird point in the cycle and leaves Elliot, you know, what ended up being Elliot Straub, right? Leaves Elliot in a really weird spot now coming in. And as far as like expectations are concerned, I think everybody was expecting UVA to take a step back, but from like a fan base standpoint, to have 2 years where you're missing bowls after just watching what Mendenhall did, right? Rolling out, you know, went to an Orange Bowl, multiple bowl appearances, and then to have the first 2 years be real bad, and then now you're going into year three. Like, what's the sell to the fan base on the Elliott regime, I guess, relative to like what Mendenhall said? Like, was the fan base expecting it to be quite this rocky through 2 years?
No, because honestly, like and again, I'm not trying to make excuses. You have to win games. That first year, things were expected to be better. Because they got Brendan Armstrong to come back, right? And he had just thrown for like 5,000 yards. And they got Wicks to come back and Lavelle Davis was coming back. And they did lose guys like at the offensive line, but when you bring back a quarterback that set all those records, it was easy to kind of paper over the areas where you might have issues. And people were like, oh, Tony Elliott's gonna come in and, you know, they're gonna run like a more balanced offense, and you know, Brandon won't have to be like, you know, running for his life all the time because they're throwing 70 times a game. And, you know, the defense could be better because the defense Broncos last year was atrocious. And, you know, Nick Howell moved on to Vanderbilt and he's already been fired from that job. Now he's back with Bronco in New Mexico. But yeah, I mean, like, I think the expectations were that they would be a bowl team in 2022, his first year, because, and maybe again, this is where it's like, maybe that's not fair because it's a new coach, first time head coach. But their schedule looked really soft on paper, like in that year, they were playing Richmond, Illinois was on their schedule, who were terrible the year before. And then they beat UVA, and ODU was on the schedule, and Coastal at home. They never even played that game because of the shooting. Obviously, like, Tech wasn't supposed to be very good.
That was winnable for
yeah,
UVA.
I mean, like, yeah, who knows what would have happened in that game. But, like, you know, Syracuse was better than people thought they would be that year. Duke was way better than people thought they were going to be. But those were all games where we were looking at them like, oh, they can win in these games. Like, and maybe that was because the bar was raised from, Broncos' tenure, where, you know, UVA fans and media were kind of expecting more competency, and it just didn't look that way. And it looked like a first-year head coach with, like, a brand-new team. And then this year, I think the expectations are last year, I should say 2023, the expectations were very low, and they basically met those expectations. They didn't go 0-12. And, you know, like, so they were picked last in the league, and they didn't finish last, but they were pretty close. And, you know, I think you go into this year, and I think there were a lot of people that were kind of like, early in the season, 2023, were kind of like, I don't think this is going well. And then they beat North Carolina and look competitive against Miami, and they beat Duke, and everybody was like, okay, well, let's see what happens. And then you lose 55-17 to your rival. And that's where it becomes harder to, like, connect with the fans if you don't win in 2024. Is like, when is it gonna like turn, you know? And you're seeing other schools do it. I think the worst thing that could have happened to Tony Elliott was Mike Elko's success at Duke, because people were like, that roster was worse than ours, and look how many games they've won. And maybe that's just because Elko's great. Maybe that was just kind of lightning in a bottle. We don't know.
They were doing that in Blacksburg too, yeah. Justin, after year one with Pry, it was a very similar thing. Look what Elko did in year one.
And now, like, Tech is kind of like the benchmark now, where it's like, well, Tech has already kind of turned it around and they're a bowl team now. So it's like, what are we doing? And I think, like, they're getting the patience to the point where it's like, no, but there isn't like a mass protest for him to be fired or anything like that. We haven't reached the Mike London levels of like, he's got to go, even though we like him, sort of thing. With Tony, it's sort of like, you know, a lot of fans are just kind of checked out anyway. And that's just the apathy around the program right now, which isn't good. And that's something they're trying to combat. But, like, you know, I think this year will be the benchmark, you know. He's either going to turn it around and they're going to be better, or he's not. And frankly, I think if he doesn't, then I think he's probably gone.
Just for the record, I believe I'm higher on this staff and this regime at this point right now than I was this time last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am too.
Me too. Like, yeah. Me
back
too.
Back to back 3-win seasons, you'd think I'd be lower after the second one, but like, I just, again, I felt like I saw improvement. I thought I saw growth through the year, and that's promising to me.
It's purely in the eye of the beholder, because, like, you know, I talk to a lot of fans who get really frustrated with the losses, but I'm looking at it and I'm like, they were almost beat Miami as like a 20-point underdog on the road. They almost beat Louisville as like a 20-point underdog on the road. Like, they were winning in the fourth quarter. Maybe you could say, like, they could have won it in, like, the JMU game. I mean, JMU was, what, like, 11-1? And UVA was up 13 on them in the fourth quarter, and then they had, like, an hour and a half rain delay. And then JMU comes out of the delay and scores two quick touchdowns and wins the game. Yep. You know, it's like, if that game goes different, maybe your season goes different. The Boston College game, they were up 14, you know, and they blew that one. And, again, you don't get it. You still blew the lead. Like, it's not like that's a good thing necessarily, but – you know, I think, like, they were competitive against a lot of teams that they probably shouldn't have been or weren't expected to be. And, you know, the offense improved, and they looked more like a competent team. Like, they didn't have, like, the issues with the penalties and the year one stuff. You know, you see, they cleaned a lot of that stuff up. It's just like, they had some special teams issues and the defense regressed, and they didn't have enough consistency, especially late in games. But, like, you know, I think they were certainly much more competitive in some games than I thought they would be. And you just have to find a way to translate that into wins. Like, you know, you have to turn a close loss against NC State at the gun to like a 3-point win. Yep. So you just need to be like a little bit more efficient. And, you know, they're either going to, like, I know it sounds kind of like simple, but they're either going to do that or they're not. Like, you know, at this point, we'll just have to see what happens. Like, you know, and I think, like I said, if they do, then I think if they go 6-6 in year three, I think there's a lot of reason for optimism, given all the stuff that happened in the first 2 years. If they go 3-9, I don't really see what the pitch is, you know, going forward. Yeah. So
there's so many 50-50 games too. Like we were talking about, it just feels like,
yeah,
Wake, you know, Ford, a coin Pittsburgh, flip. Yeah. You know, it's a coin flip in several games, and you know, it really doesn't take a whole lot of results to go differently to end up at 6-6. I mean, mm-hmm. you're talking about the 1-point loss to JMU. You're talking about that Miami and Louisville game, like two games where you're not even expected to be competitive.
I mean, right? NC State's the perfect example. Like, NC State, Calandria takes them down. They They tie the game. All right, so they score a touchdown to go down by two. Then they get a penalty for like a after the whistle penalty on one offensive lineman.
Heinous.
Which is like, what are you doing? Then he completes the 2-point conversion from the 17. And then he took his helmet off, which was kind of like accidental, but he took his helmet off and then they kick off from their own 15 or whatever. So NC State gets a short field and then go down and kick a game winning field goal. Like you're like one penalty away from maybe winning that game. You know, JMU, they had him in like third and 15, I think at one point with like a minute, you know, like you're talking about like literally like three or four plays you could have won. And I don't think they would have been a bowl team necessarily, but maybe like, instead of 3-9, you go 5-7.
And then optically speaking, like this thing looks entirely better. Right. It looks a lot better probably going into year three where, okay, well, now you've established a 5-win benchmark in year two. Okay, if you don't necessarily make a bowl game, but you win 5 after winning 5 the previous year, it's like, all right, this is at least close to bowl eligibility. We know we have a track versus going, you know, whatever it was, 1 win, 3 wins, whatever they won year one. Was it 1 or 2 wins in year one?
It was, they won three.
Three? Yeah.
But it was a 3-7.
Yeah, 3-7. Yeah. So 3-7.
And those
wins
were bad wins. I mean, they beat Richmond. They beat a really bad ODU team at the gun on a field goal. And then they beat Georgia Tech on the road. And Georgia Tech was playing like me at quarterback, I think, in that game.
Yeah, banged up.
Because Jeff Sims got hurt.
Yeah. That was the quarterback ran out of bounds.
Yeah, exactly. After time that was so bad. That was a terrible football game.
I'm still mad
on a
about
Thursday
that.
Night.
Joey, it was an aneurysm situation for Joey. It was not good.
Yeah, that was really bad. But yeah. I mean, you just have to find a way to like, I don't think they're going to start blowing people out this year, but they need to at least turn some of these close losses into close wins. And I think they can do it. I wouldn't necessarily bet my life savings that they're going to do it. But because I think you still have a talent deficit. And I think that honestly might be a case for the staff is like they've been competitive with a roster that's not as good as the rosters they're playing against.
Yeah.
And it's like maybe the staff can figure out a way to like maximize things. But, you know, you have to turn that like, I hope they do it or I think they might do it into some sort of like proof that you can do it. You know?
Yeah. To me, the most impressive stretch of the season, there was 4 games, 3 of them on the road, win at North Carolina, overtime at Miami, and then going into Louisville, had a lead in the fourth quarter on a Thursday night, like all that. That was really impressive to me. The one game in between was getting blown out by Georgia Tech. And Georgia Tech guy here, like, that should not have been a blowout. But as you mentioned, I mean, Tony Muskie gets hurt at the end of the first drive. Anthony Calandria thought he was redshirting. Like,
yeah, that one went sideways too. It was close until like halfway through the second quarter. And then Georgia Tech ran all over them too. That was kind of like a weird. But that's another thing. Like, if you want to make the case against the staff, you had that game. You had the Virginia Tech game where like they did whatever they wanted to do on both sides of the ball after having lost the week before on your home field. Tennessee at the beginning of the year, that game was like, oh, well, they're going to get destroyed. And they did, but Tennessee ended up being like, okay, like not as good as they were the year before. And certainly not a team that you have to lose to 49-10 or whatever it was. And then Maryland, they were up 14-0 and then lost like 42-14. So, I mean, there were some blowouts in there too. The BC game, like, you know, that was terrible in the second half. And, you know, so they're going to have to do a lot better. But, you know, I think that they're going to be one of those ACC teams. It's like they could finish 7-5. They could finish 4-8, like right in the middle. And, you know, you just have to, I think the results matter at some point. Yep.
Mike, I'm good. Anything else for Justin while we got him?
Oh, real quick, just like recruiting trend wise, like, How is the staff recruiting relative to what the expectations were coming in? Has that improved, gotten worse? Like, how's that looking in terms of...
I would say, like, it was slow starting. You know, they kind of got a late start in that first class. And then their first full class, I think, was not... I don't want to say, like, they don't have talent in that class. But, like, they took some flyers. I think they kind of struggled to kind of get their footing. And you had a lot of guys on that staff that were not from here. You're trying to recruit this area, and you know that takes time. The 2024 class that they just signed is small, so it's not ranked high because they only signed like 13 guys. But there's not like a, I don't think there's a lot of like reaches in that group. They're all pretty solid. And then this 2025 class, they're actually doing quite well. They have three commits already. A four-star receiver who's like a top 10 player in Virginia, who's good. They already got their quarterback, who's a good player from New England. And then they got a lineman from Nashville that's good. So I think if they can put this together, then, you know, like if they can continue to get guys like that, I mean, that's, those are ACC caliber players in the 2025 class for sure. And you just have to find a way to get more of those guys and fill your roster out with those guys and then supplement in the portal instead of trying to like make your roster through the portal.
Yeah.
Because only Louisville can do that.
so far.
And Colorado's going to try. You don't want to be in that situation. So we'll see. But again, like, you know, I was talking about this with the buddy recently. Like, it's really great to see them succeeding in this 2025 class, but it's so early and it means nothing if they don't win games. Like, because if this group doesn't win games, like
25 is going to be out. Yeah.
A new guy is going to be re-recruiting those guys in a few months.
Yeah.
So,
Especially in the portal era. I mean, it's such a dangerous thing to like somewhat base, do we fire him or not decision on like, well, with the recruiting class coming in, it's like,
yeah,
those guys could all be gone within a year if you keep them anyways. So like, you know, I'd like to think you'd just kind of ignore that at this point, but who knows?
Yeah, exactly. And also I think schools are going to have to get used to there being blips where, like, you know, we were just talking about like Tony's kind of development. It's like first year kind of like reconstruction, second year it's like try to just get through it and do the best you can with a young team, and then this year you should see the gains. And that's kind of the old school way, like that's how it used to be. It takes a couple years and then we're going to get good. And that's still going to be the case for some schools. But nowadays with the portal, you're going to see a school like Louisville or whoever that are just immediately really good. But then the next year, they might be much worse because they just didn't get the right guys. And it won't be as linear. So, like, if Tony Elliott nailed all of his transfers this year, they could go 8-4. And then it's like, oh, man, they're doing great. But then 2025 comes and they don't hit on those guys and they're back to being bad again. You know, so I think schools like Virginia are probably going to be more volatile than they used to be, up and down. And, you know, you'll see that, especially if you get the quarterback right. So,
and Joey and I had a discussion recently. We were like just talking about the portal in general. I am curious if some schools just nail a portal class, right? And they come in, you know, staff comes in. I mean, Brom's a great example, Louisville, right? Come in year one, they're really good against a soft schedule. And then I know they're just raiding the portal and it's looking really good again. But let's say year two, all of a sudden they're like 6-6 or something. It's like, did you just set expectations way too high because you just happened to, you know, kind of get lucky a little bit and just nail every portal guy that you went in and grabbed? Like, and now all of a sudden your expectations are up here. And now that you're like meeting expectations, it's not going to be good enough for the fan base. I'm just wondering if like some of these coaches,
we call that the Justin Fuente.
It's the Justin Fuente. It's like you're inadvertently like handcuffing yourself and you have no idea until after the fact.
Mel Tucker is another example. Mel Tucker, where he had like a bad first year and then his second year they were like really, really good because they got like a few good transfers and then they weren't able to repeat it.
We'll
see. I mean, UVA is not in that situation because I don't think they brought in enough guys to be in that situation, but you know, they're going to need some of these guys to hit for sure. So,
Justin, this has been awesome. As Mike mentioned before, you are always so generous with your time. We really appreciate it. Do you want to tell the people real quick where they can go find your stuff?
Yeah. CavsCorner.com. It's on the Rivals Network. You can find all of our stuff. It's mostly basketball right now. As UVA tries to figure out if they're any good or not, as we move into February. So we'll see what happens there, but yeah, football, spring football right around the corner for sure. So,
really appreciate it, Justin.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Thanks for joining us.
Yep.
We would love to have you on again sometime soon, especially at the very least to preview next season, but maybe sometime else this offseason. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
Awesome. Mike, you want to work on getting out of here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter, at FTRS Joey, at Mike McDaniel SI, at BC Podcast ACC, at Justin_Ferber for Justin on the Twitter network. He's with the Rivals network as well, so go find that.
Twitter network.
You can send us an email, questions, comments, concerns, basketballconferencepodcast@gmail.com.
Nailed it.
Thank you. iTunes, Spotify, all the good places you go find podcasts. Mike, we're also on the social medias.
Facebook, facebook.com/basketballconference. Rate, review, find some of our podcasts there. Instagram at BC Podcast ACC. YouTube.com/@TheACCFootballPodcast. Please subscribe.
Please subscribe, like, rate, review, hit the bell icon, all those things that people tell you to do. Appreciate that. Mike, you want to come back? Keep previewing, good grief. Recapping some more teams?
If we take too long on the recaps, we'll be into preview season, so we better speed that up.
They'll start turning into previews. That's right.
That's right.
Yep. Awesome. Sounds good. We will talk to you all again very, very soon to preview some more team. Recap some more teams. Good grief. I need to go to bed. Recap some more teams. Until then, for Mr. Mike McDaniel and Mr. Justin Ferber, I am Joey Weaver. Thank you guys so much for listening. We will talk to you again very, very soon. Until then, go Hoos.
Virginia's awesome.
And go ACC.